Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club, and I would very much like to introduce Carter Roberts. He is, as you know, the CEO and president of the World Wildlife Fund. He joined the fund in 2004, and before that was vice president for global strategic planning at the Nature Conservancy. And the World Wildlife Fund promotes a science-based approach to conservation, running more than 1,200 field projects around the world, studying forests, oceans, and coasts, freshwater, endangered species, toxic chemicals, and climate change. And Mr. Roberts has been a major influence in forging public-private partnerships on conservation. Welcome, Carter Roberts.
Thank you.
As you probably know, the World Wildlife Fund was founded out of the UK 46 years ago. By biologist Sir Julian Huxley and ornithologist Sir Peter Scott. And apparently Huxley was a hunter, and he came back from Africa and told stories about the disappearance of animals and of the shrinking of the biological diversity. And Scott came up with the Panda logo, which is the organization's. They're lucky to have it. Now, originally, the World Wildlife Fund focused on saving pandas and tigers in India and snow leopards in Nepal. And then, of course, the group realized that they couldn't save animals without saving their habitats. And they couldn't save the habitats without preserving and controlling the resource use. And that's what the organization is doing now. Now, I wanted to ask you, Mr. Roberts, would you please give us an example, or a few, if you'd be so kind, of how the World Wildlife Fund is working with people and with governments to protect resources for wildlife and people?
Great. Thanks. The beginning of any story like that, I think, you have to comment on the fact that World Wildlife Fund is a truly global organization. We have offices all around the world. And so when we approach something like saving the Amazon or saving Borneo, the question is not how do we just act from here in the United States. The question is how do you marshal all the resources of the world to save a place like that. So I'll give you two examples. I went to the Amazon a month ago and visited a site, Camp 41, which some of you may have heard of. It's a place where Tom Lovejoy has been doing research on the Amazon for 40 years. And Camp 41 is the control plot. It's the plot that establishes the baseline of what rainforests are supposed to look like. And in a single morning, I saw 45 new species of birds I'd never seen before. We had troops of monkeys going through the treetops. Just this magical place. And we left that to go to another test site where the forest had been diminished and it had half the number of species. And then we went to a town of Santarem in the southeastern edge of the Amazon where you can see the forces at work that are changing the Amazon. And what you see is mile after mile after mile of foot-high crops. And it's all soybean. It's this just endless monoculture of soybean. And we saw the port facility for Cargill, which is this privately held company based out of Minneapolis. That is the world's largest producer and exporter of soybean from the Amazon. And when you look at the maps and you look at the land use changes in the Amazon, it is all about the conversion of the forest to livestock, but increasingly to soy. And you might ask, is Brazil suddenly developed this newfound appetite for soy? And in fact, most of it is being exported to China. increasingly, to feed livestock, to feed China's change in consumption patterns. And so if you want to save the Amazon, you can create parks, and we have this astonishing program with the government of Brazil to create a system of parks the size of California in the Amazon. And this year, 6 million hectares of new parks have been created in the Amazon. In fact, just last week, a new park, 2.1 million hectares in size, has been created. But you also have to go to China and start to engage the Chinese government on how soy is imported, and you need to engage Cargill on how it's produced. And we are increasingly developing an agricultural commodities program to provide guidance on how you can produce the same amount of soy in a much smaller footprint. And so we have this big Amazon program. A lot of it's about parks, but a lot of it increasingly is about how you produce soy and how you export it and how it moves around the world. The second example I'll give you is a more recent one, and it's all about Borneo. And it's Borneo is this tear-shaped island. It's the eastern half is Indonesia, the western half is Malaysia, and Brunei occupies a small part of it. It's the world's richest rainforest, and it's full of orangutans, and it's full of amazing plants, and it is changing before our eyes. This is where the world's greatest rates of deforestation are occurring. And we've been working on this declaration to protect the heart of Borneo with a system of parks, and we've been working with the Ministry of the Environment in Indonesia to take the lead on this. Well, one of the lessons you learn is if the only ministry you work with in any of these countries is the Ministry of the Environment, you're not going to succeed over the long run, because at precisely the time we were pushing and getting traction on this declaration of the heart of Borneo, the Minister of Agriculture announced a whole new plan to create a 4.5 million hectare palm oil plantation in the heart of Borneo, funded by the China Development Bank. And that occurred this past fall. And so we began a viral campaign, and within days an email went out to all the parts of the WWF network. WWF Netherlands, WWF Sweden, WWF UK met with their heads of state and ambassadors who engaged the Indonesian government. I met with the World Bank, with Wolfowitz and his team to talk about the crisis in Indonesia. And the World Bank program in Indonesia engaged the right people there. We engaged the Sultan of Brunei's staff. We engaged the government of Malaysia. And we engaged the companies that are putting money into the China Development Bank, which a lot of the companies we all know on Wall Street put their money into the China Development Bank. And all of this, and the last thing we did was we created a study that showed the economics of palm oil plantations in this part of Borneo that showed only 10% of this plan would be profitable, and proved that, in fact, the palm oil plantation was a Trojan horse. It wasn't about palm oil, because 90% of it would not produce any profits. It was about sucking out the trees and selling them and people making money on that. And so we've now developed a map of more profitable parts of Borneo to plant palm oil. The government has just declared that they're going to oppose the palm oil plantation, and the crisis has been averted for now.
That's really an amazing story. And it's interesting because you have a slightly different background than many of the CEOs of international environmental organizations. You have an MBA from Harvard. You have a wide business experience with Gillette and with Procter & Gamble. Do you think that helped you in being able to move into these worlds and get in on these negotiations?
It is true. I think most of my colleagues who are heads of other environmental groups are lawyers, typically. And when I got out of Harvard, I tried to get a job in this field and found that people were hiring either lawyers, scientists to do research, or lawyers to use that research to sue and litigate. And what I find, at least my background is useful in, is increasingly people look at our work not as donors but as investors, and they demand results on their investment. And so we develop goals for our organization. We've developed metrics for tracking performance toward those goals and reporting back to investors. And I've also found that it's really useful to think about what motivates really big companies and their behavior. And they care above all else about their brand, and they care about the consequences of the value of their brand for their shareholders. And when it's pointed out that some of the things they're doing will negatively affect their brand over the long run, that's really motivating to companies in terms of changing their behavior, and we can help guide how they might improve their practices. So there's a real opportunity over time.
Well, if you could tell us about two of the companies that you've worked with, Coca-Cola and Walmart, if you could talk to us briefly about how did you help the environment through your arrangements with them?
Great. Yeah, 20 years ago, I think a lot of environmentalists, their eyebrows would really raise if you...
And still do.
And still do. That you're actually talking to Coca-Cola or Walmart. Coca-Cola is the world's largest buyer of sugar, the world's largest buyer of aluminum, the world's largest buyer of vanilla, the second biggest buyer of coffee, the second biggest buyer of citrus. And when you go to any of the places we care about, the forces that are changing the face of the world in those places are how those kind of products are produced and sold. And we have begun to work with Coca-Cola on how they can change their supply chain practices, increase standards for sourcing those materials more efficiently. But really interestingly, how Coke uses water. There's a water crisis around the world that's affecting people, but also nature. Coke has 1,000 bottling plants around the world, and we've begun to do studies of how Coke uses water. And a liter of Coke, you'd be surprised how much water it takes to produce a liter of Coke. There's the liter that goes into the bottle itself. There's a liter and a half that goes into cleaning the plant in between Coke and the other products. But then when you factor in the amount of water it takes to produce the sugar in a bottle of Coke, it's 140 liters of water. And so when you talk about the water crisis in the world, think about the influence that Coca-Cola has in changing the way that sugar is produced and also increasing the efficiency of their plants. And so we're setting hard targets for Coke to increase the total efficiency of the water use for their product. And we'll measure progress towards that over time. And this past year, we've just worked with Walmart, which is the second biggest buyer of fish in the United States. And Walmart has just committed to source all their wild fish only from MSC, Marine Stewardship Council certified fisheries, which has sent shockwaves throughout the fisheries community as fishing fleets are now struggling how to adjust because Walmart's so big. And if Walmart sets a standard at this level, then everybody is struggling on how to change their practices to reach that standard. So those are two examples.
Thank you. I also wanted you to talk about, if you have time, about some of the studies that World Wildlife Fund supports. They're coming across my desk all the time on climate change, biological diversity. Could you talk about some of them?
Sure. Science is a fundamental part of our work, and it's part of our brand. You talked about the panda logo, and it stands for... part of what it stands for is the science and integrity in dealing with companies like Walmart and Coke, but also governments, and they look to us for science. And one of the most interesting studies we've done recently is of imminent extinctions in the world. And we're a lead author on a consortium-produced study of those places in the world where we are on the edge of losing species. And these are places where that's the only place that species exists, where its population is so small, and where this is our last chance to save them. And we've documented 794 species in a number of places about half that size, and we've pinpointed where those places are around the world as a blueprint for avoiding extinction. And Chris mentioned we have this new partnership with Stanford and the Nature Conservancy to study and demonstrate the value of intact ecosystems to people in places like California and China and Tanzania, because increasingly people are only willing to conserve ecosystems if it's demonstrated that it's in their best interest to do so. And so we're doing increasing scientific studies that demonstrate the connection between a forest and clean drinking water and between the Amazon and climate change.
Good, thank you. One of the studies that I saw had to do with dioxin contamination. I mean, it's a very wide range of subject matter that you support.
Right.
Are there any other studies that you could talk to us about?
Sure. One of the roles that we play in the climate change debate is telling the story of the impact of climate change on places around the world. And we are working with a indigenous community in Alaska to track the change of contaminants in their ecosystem and also in their blood over a period of decades. We're tracking the change in the makeup of species in places like the Andes and in coral reefs in places like Indonesia. And what you're seeing is that these ecosystems are changing before our very eyes. And as a result of climate change, as a result of toxins being borne by the wind from China, and as a result of these global forces that we don't see, but when you have the patience to sit in a place and look at what happens to it over time, it is stunning. And the world is waking up to the impact that we're having and beginning to take action.
Now, some people who are committed to environmental work say that they first got interested because of some experience they had as a young child, some beauty in nature that they saw. And I wondered if that was true in your case.
Yeah, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, in what has been set aside as a Civil War battlefield, and it's I used to disappear into the woods behind my house and into the streams and would turn over logs and find these jewels of these salamanders that just were magic to me. And that was an experience that I've just carried with me the rest of my life. And E.O. Wilson talks about the importance of curiosity in teaching kids to turn over logs. And just last week before I came out here, I took my son into our backyard in Washington, D.C., and we found a stream, and we started turning over logs, and we found a salamander. And, you know, I think that is so fundamental to what's going to happen to the next generations, and whether or not they really have this connection to the earth is whether or not we give them the opportunity to explore and turn over logs. And I think that's, I think everybody in our field has that kind of experience sometimes.
That's true. Now, I also understand that you're a very enthusiastic birder.
Obsessive would be another word for it.
I see there are other birders in the audience. And I was wondering if you could share some of your memorable birding experiences with us.
Well, you know, birders are an odd lot. One of the great things about birding is I started birding in the cemetery in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when I was in school there. And you go out in the morning, and there would be, you'd have a venture capitalist, a meat packer, a scientist, and they were all, nobody knew, nobody talked about work, nobody talked about issues of the day. What you talked about was the bird's song and the identification of the bird, and it was this unbelievable collection of people. And no matter where you go in the world, if you bump into other birders and strange things happen. And I'll never forget being on the small Oakmont off the coast of Texas at the height of spring migration, and this it's this little 1-acre parcel of woods, And if you catch it just right, when spring migration occurs, it's the only place where warblers have to collapse at the end of flying over the Gulf. And if you catch it just right, the woods are dripping with these little jewels of warblers of every shape, size, and color. And I was there, and I said to somebody, do you know where there's a good spot around here to see yellow rails, which is this cryptic, thin, you know, thin as a rail refers to rails. It doesn't refer to to finch rails. It refers to these birds that disappear into marsh grass. I'd never seen one. And the person looked at me, and these are birds that are really hard to see. He says, what size shoe do you wear? And I said, 9 1/2. And he said, how much time do you have? And I said, 30 minutes. And he said, hop in my truck. And I hopped in the truck, and he fished out a pair of 9 1/2 boots, gave them to me, and he took me by the hand, and we wandered off into this marshland, and he gave a few calls, and these yellow rails just popped right out almost into our hands. And it was just one of those magical experiences, and you have those all the time.
That's amazing.
So
now, when you worry at night about the world, what spots do you worry the most about where we have to move the fastest to save them?
I worry about we've identified 20 places on Earth that we should worry about. And it's hard to, it's like choosing between your children. I worry about the Amazon, because as we lose the Amazon, it's going to affect climate change like you wouldn't believe. I worry about the Bering Sea, because it's the biggest fishery in the United States, and nobody knows anything about it. It's between Alaska and Russia, and it's where we catch most of our whitefish. Nobody knows about it, and it's getting fish clean. I worry about places like Borneo, where these spectacular vertebrates like orangutans, the predictions are that we won't have them after the turn of the century because of the land use patterns that are there. And we as a movement need to tell these stories about these places, and what's affecting them is not just local forces, it is the way we as a nation act and consume and our business practices. And we have to tell these stories so we change those practices before it's too late. So well, I stay awake at night a lot.
I imagine you do. I imagine we all do. Thank you so much. We wanted to take questions, and I would like to open up the microphone. You can all just step up if you'd like, if you have any questions for Mr. Robertson. He would, I'm sure, be glad to answer them. Now, have you ever lived in the Bay Area?
I have never lived in the Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
I have dreamed of living in the Bay Area, but I've never lived in the Bay Area.
That's
it's a spectacular area, and it's where you know, California is setting the standard for what we should do as a country, whether it's climate change and emissions from cars, where you're doing exactly what our country should be doing as a whole, or the new marine protected areas effort that's underway, which, I mean, you've all heard about Bush's, the president's declaration of this new, the biggest marine protected area on Earth. The Northwest Hawaiian Islands. It's bigger than the Great Barrier Reef in Australia that's just happened.
Just today he announced it.
Yeah, so it is some. But I think one of the great things about California, and people are increasingly realizing, is the marine system here, which is part of a bigger marine system. But you're really doing some great things.
Yes. All right. Would you like to ask your question?
Sure. Just listening to your talk, you've really posed a lot of daunting challenges, and just wanted to focus for a second on the Amazon and the companies that are really key behind the destruction of the rainforest there. Cargill, ADM. And I'm wondering, relative to World Wildlife Fund's strategy, which tends to be very cooperative, very diplomatic, quite subtle, what do you do with challenges like that? Obviously, those two companies don't see the threat to their brand equity in what they're doing. They instead see the opportunities in doing business with China. And do you leave those kinds of problems to others? I'm sure you're familiar with groups like Forest Ethics that are a little bit more scrappy. They certainly are much more confrontational. How do you propose to deal with some of those problems that are so big?
First of all, scrappy is one of my favorite words. And I don't think we're quite that subtle. In fact, I think WWF, the panda actually has teeth. And we do challenge companies more than some other organizations do. When I was in Santarem, Greenpeace had just issued a broadside that had outlined a lot of the issues around Cargill's activities in the Amazon. And they did it in a way that I don't think we would do it, but every bumper sticker in Santarem said, "Greenpeace, go home. The Amazon belongs to Brazilians." And there is an opening here to engage Cargill in a frank and open assessment of what the impact of their activities are on the Amazon, and to engage them and to look for some solutions, but to not be a shill for any company. You know, one thing we will never do is be a shill for any company. We have pushed oil companies on their activities in Camisea pipeline in Peru, the BTC pipeline in Turkey. And one of the reasons companies want to work with us is because we stand for a certain level of standard in terms of kind of expectations about environmental practices. We produce something called BankTrack, which is a measure of the level of compliance that Equator Principle banks, most banks have signed on to these Equator Principles governing the lending practices. That doesn't mean that they always lend according to the Equator Principles. And so we produce a report every year evaluating banks and their performance against those principles. And I think that's a really important thing to do for an organization like WWF. So.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks.
Hi, Holly Kaufman. Welcome to California.
Thanks, Sarah.
It's great to get the East Coast groups out here. And also really wonderful to hear about how you're using your business acumen in an environmental organization. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the difference between WWF, or the differences and similarities between WWF and TNC, the Nature Conservancy, having served in a that smile, in a management capacity in both, because I think both organizations have evolved a lot over the years, and great to hear about the cooperative venture you're doing with Stanford. So if you could differentiate the brands of the two organizations, that would be great.
Yeah, brands are really interesting. Brands are, first of all, we're not an East Coast organization.
That's true, but I lived in D.C., so I think of you as that.
We are the most global conservation organization there is, and we have independent WWF organizations around the world that have their own boards, and they have their own character. And so that's one way in which we're different from TNC, which is a single 501c3 based in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. that is really wanting to become more global. We're an organization that has independent chapters all around the world. Mm-hmm. And so when I attend a meeting of my colleagues at WWF, they are they're from all over the world. They have different perspectives. And the governance in WWF is inherently a very different thing than it is with TNC. Mm-hmm. TNC is a very complex mission. It's known for buying land to save it. Of course, we all know that TNC does a lot more than that. We're known for the people who save pandas. But as I just described, we do a lot more than that, too. But I'd say probably the most fundamental difference that I've seen in the two organizations is WWF has evolved as having very strong field units, just like the Nature Conservancy, but also having a very strong policy program, which reflects kind of a common U.S.-European heritage. but also the fact that we represent a merger. And Russ Train, who was my predecessor, was the head of World Wildlife Fund, and Bill Riley was the head of a group called the Conservation Foundation. And they decided to merge 20 years ago. And one was this scrappy policy group, and the other one was this field-based group. The fact that both of them went on to become head of EPA is a whole other matter, but we reflect the kind of the product of this merger. And so the great challenge for us is linking this policy work with the field-based work. And I think that is something that we uniquely can deliver. They're both really great organizations, and they're different, and I'm glad they both exist. So.
Thank you. Hi, I'm with Commonwealth Club and also the Sierra Club. I was listening to Terry Gross yesterday and almost fell out of my seat in the car. She was interviewing a person who wrote a book called The North Pole Was Here. And in it, we're talking about, you know, global climate change's effect on the seas and the ice flows. And he made a comment at the end of it that said that there are companies that are now speculating on the huge oil reserves that will now be available to them once we've melted the seas. And it's as though it's like, well, a little climate change, no problem. We'll just adjust, and then we'll go out pioneering and see if we can make hay with all this. So it was the first time I'd ever heard of the global climate change issue in terms of an opportunity to make money. So do you have any comments on that?
Sure. All these companies are evaluating what is happening and changing in the world, and they see business opportunities. Goldman Sachs just announced that they have committed to creating a whole new environmental markets program, and that anticipates what's going to happen as a result of climate treaties, as a result of natural resources being finite. And now Goldman is doing it by all, and I think everybody truly believes this, because there is a real commitment at Goldman to kind of social responsibility, but also there's an opportunity there. You know, there will be an opportunity there. Those oil companies are not the only ones. Other people see, other institutions see what's going to happen to growing seasons, mm-hmm. and the increased land area in which they can plant certain crops. And you're going to see a lot of people looking at the business opportunities around climate change, around the regulation, but also around the fact that the Earth's resources are finite. There's going to be conflict over those resources. And if they can get there first, there's going to be a competitive advantage to do that. I mean, when the ice cap melts, there's going to be a new shipping lane mm-hmm. that is going to, you know, Panama's widening their canal. But there's a great debate in Panama whether or not they should widen the canal, because there are going to be other ways for people to ship their products, and not just through that tiny little isthmus. And so businesses do a great job of planning 50 years out. And I wish our administration was doing a better job of planning 50 years out and doing something about it now.
Thank you. Carl Close with the Independent Institute. Last Sunday, the San Francisco Chronicle ran an article by Mark Dowie, fascinating article about one of the unintended consequences of conservation in third world countries, and that is the displacement of indigenous populations. When protection of wildlife is the primary goal, there are sometimes casualties. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on how to protect the rights of indigenous people.
Yeah, WWF was the first international conservation group to publish a policy in 1996, affirming the rights of indigenous peoples and essentially stating principles that we need to follow in our work, which is to affirm their rights to the natural resources, to their use, and also the right to prior informed consent for any actions that might affect those. And we work with indigenous peoples all over the world, whether it's Kayapo in the Amazon. I mentioned groups in Alaska. Just about everywhere we work, there are indigenous peoples, and we work closely with them in pursuing the objectives that we have. We have this program in the Amazon that I mentioned that has a goal of creating 125 million acres of new protected areas. 20% of the Amazon is already in indigenous reserves. And what we committed to with the government of Brazil and the World Bank is a process of designing and implementing that program that gives indigenous peoples more than just a voice, actually veto power over any of those parks. And so as part of this program, before any park is actually created, if it abuts an indigenous reserve, the indigenous people actually have a right to veto that project before it occurs. Now, what's interesting is in Latin America, increasingly conservation is devolving to a local level, but in Africa, there are places where the head of state can just decree top-down that a park will be created. And that's happened in Gabon. It's happened in some other places. And I think Mark Dowie was referring to some of those countries in which that has occurred. And WWF is not aware of any of the projects we're involved with that have affected indigenous peoples in that way. But we're committed to continuing to improve. And I think governance is a fundamental issue in conservation. And I think we all need to do a much better job of taking into account the voices of the people who live there and determining what happens to those places.
Can you suggest some ways that donors can make sure that their dollars don't go toward those kinds of programs? The programs that displace indigenous peoples, and instead give them some kind of veto power such as yours?
Yeah, I would suggest that if... It's interesting. There's one of the leading donors to saving the Amazon is the Moore Foundation right here. And the Moore Foundation is so involved in the details of the design of this ARPA project, including this governance structure. And it's really a model. And I would suggest that other institutional investors in those type of programs state clear expectations about those principles and that the project respects those principles, because it's fundamental and it's important.
Thank you.
Hi, Charlie Knowles with the Wildlife Conservation Network. And I want to talk a little bit about the funding end of things. In 2005, about $250 billion was given in the U.S. from individuals and foundations to various philanthropic causes. And less than 0.1% of that went to international conservation causes. What can we do to increase the size of that pie?
Great question. It's very interesting. There are all kinds of strategic reasons why the United States government and why people who live in the United States should support conservation outside of our borders. It's where most of the fish comes from that we eat. These are the places that are going to affect climate change. And these are also natural resource conflict has a lot to do with stability and security issues. And we need to tell much better stories that bring it home, the impact of losing these systems to all of us here at home. But we also need to build, I think, a political force that is capable of raising these issues and bringing it to Congress and bringing it to people and with greater clarity. We have one of the most promising things in Congress right now is a new caucus that the WWF, the Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, and WCS have helped form. It's a bipartisan caucus. It's the International Conservation Caucus. And we are in the process of developing a case statement for what needs to be conserved in the world and what is it going to cost, and making that clear and putting that out there. And I think that shouldn't just be shared with Congress. It should be shared more broadly. And I think the imperative is for all the major conservation groups to come together with a common message, with urgency and a price tag for what it's going to cost.
Great. Thank you. I might just add, from my perspective, I think your earlier statement about treating donors as investors is really important, too, in realizing that people expect deliverables and they expect metrics and they want to see results like you've outlined that you've accomplished. So, thank you.
Yeah, you know, one last thing I'd say. 2 weeks ago, we announced a $20 million gift from Roger Sant, who's the founder of AES Corporation, to the Amazon. And increasingly, what we find is individuals want to leave a legacy. They want to know that they made a difference. And so people are increasingly looking for individual projects where they can really focus their giving and know that it's going to have an impact. And so one of the challenges that we have is to make it easier for people to identify a particular project and be an investor rather than just a donor.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello, my name is Carter Brooks. So Koch was mentioned earlier, and Koch owns one of our homegrown enterprises, the Odwalla Juice Company, which was founded by a few musicians who came back from traveling and found they couldn't get the fresh-squeezed juice they got on the streets while they were traveling back here, which is a way of introducing the idea that Koch, that was an idea that grew into a juice company, and Koch has been very successful at selling the idea that drinks are carbonated sugar water. So just with the thought of beyond water use and sugar, you know, if you could get Coke to think about changing what people want to drink with their power, I want to ask you, following up on what places are you worried about in the world, what ideas are you worried about or most concerned about?
You mean what? Can I just ask you a clarifying question? Do you mean what ideas am I worried about because they're threatening, or what ideas do I think we need to advance?
Which I almost asked you both. I didn't want to give you two questions. Either or. I'm most curious in what ideas you're worried about being endangered, but clearly there's ideas that I would also worry about the power of them.
I can't speak to Coke is an amazing marketing machine, and what one of the things they want to do is use their marketing power to raise the awareness of freshwater issues and freshwater conservation in the world, which is interesting. And the customers are all one. The trend toward healthy drinks is so profound, which is part of the reason they bought Odwalla, that I think most of those companies are responding to customer desires rather than shaping them. But that's just a whole other conversation. I think the greatest real interesting issue, and this reflects the earlier question by the lady to your left, is that I think finding some way to get markets to value intact ecosystems and bring capital to conserving them is one of the ideas that's out there that has yet to be realized. And regulation is really important. And by any stretch of the imagination, we're not going to make progress against climate change unless we've got a cap-and-trade system and the U.S. commits to the post-Kyoto Protocol along with China. There's no question about that. But at the same time, creating markets that where you can... You know, you look at the amount of money that the private sector spends in these places around the world, but finding ways to value intact forests and clean rivers and have investors in that is really an interesting idea that we haven't yet cracked, and that's the essence of this partnership with Stanford and the Nature Conservancy, is can we somehow create some models for making that happen? And that's also Goldman Sachs is going to invest, I hope, and something related to that. If you can figure that out, then some amazing things could happen. That's an interesting idea. It hasn't been proven, at least in that specific way, to work yet, but we need to figure out a way to make that happen. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Carter. Richard Cunningham. Being that so many of WWF's strategies are based on human consumption of natural resources and protecting the environment by influencing human consumption patterns. You've got two major threats. You've got so many people in the world moving up the consumption chain from poverty into middle class, and as they do that, they consume more and more natural resources. And then you have this problem of increasing human populations everywhere in the world. How do you have meaningful influence on the consumption patterns when you have those two major threats that you just simply don't have any control over?
Yeah, we looked at the issue of population and consumption. And on the issue of population, we've made a decision as an institution that we would leave it to our local programs to engage people in those issues. And in fact, in places in Africa and the Himalayas, our programs are so integrated between healthcare issues, population, family planning, and conservation that it's hard to find the dividing line between those. But the larger issue, we decided not to take on population at a global scale. There are other organizations that do that. But we did want to take on consumption, and particularly when you look at China and you look at the math, it's the consumption side of the equation that is driving these things more than population. And our feeling is the best leverage we could have, given the limited resources we have, is to try to influence policies in terms of advancing energy efficiency policies in China, advancing purchasing policies around commodities, and doing the same here at home. So rather than taking a retail approach to influencing consumption, is to take a wholesale approach to work with Home Depot, Staples, Walmart, those kind of companies, and change the kind of products that they offer consumers so the consumers have a clearer choice. And that's a choice we're making, is to focus on those points of leverage, and because we feel like, given limited resources, that's where we're going to have the biggest impact.
Kishan Jainandan Singh, Mosaic Multimedia. Welcome to the Bay Area, the home of entrepreneurism. I belong to a startup, essentially, where we are looking at new business models, socially responsible business models. A couple of weeks ago, there was a seminar organized through the Commonwealth by Social Fusion about that particular topic. And my question really is, if you look at the previous question, how do you influence consumer behavior? Because ultimately, all these corporations like Cargill and so forth, they do things on the basis of studied consumer behavior and reacting to that, essentially. We have seen, for instance, the labeling of tuna being dolphin-safe tuna. What do you think about, you know, labeling products out there for, and I wouldn't say as much for developing or emerging nations, because still I think their consumption per capita in dollar volume is still smaller than what you have in the Western world. Think about McDonald's, essentially. You mentioned Cargill in the Amazon, but McDonald's basically farming cattle and so forth, for their Western consumption and so forth. But, you know, being able to label those products as being environmentally safe, and then following on that, what kind of programs do you have in place, or partnerships, as a matter of fact, not just with government organizations or NGOs, but also with the private industry in bringing this education to the general masses, essentially?
Great question. One of the great ideas in conservation is this idea of certification. And the WWF was one of the founders of two certification programs. And one was this Marine Stewardship Council certification, which is this stamp that for seafood, that if it's grown in a place where the ecosystem is managed in a way that's sustainable, that the resources are, they're protected areas that protect the kind of the nursery grounds, and that the level of catch is at a level that's sustainable. And we created the MSC with Unilever in a partnership, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago. And we've been waiting to reach the tipping point where not only does that mean something to consumers, but these big buyers are responding. So when Walmart makes a commitment to source MSC-certified fisheries, that's a really big deal. We've done the same thing with forest products. We're one of the founders of the Forest Stewardship Council, FSC certification, which is the highest standard for certified forest products. And we realized it wasn't enough to just do that. You also had to create a network. And so we created a network of forest product buyers and suppliers around the world. We have 450 signed up. And I know last spring I had a meeting with Anderson Windows, which you think, why would I be meeting with Anderson Windows? Well, a lot of their product line is wood. It's really high-quality wood, and they want it to be FSC certified. And they couldn't figure out where to get it. And so they worked with us through this network to find suppliers in the Russian Far East that have made this commitment. And so not only you have to create a certification standard, but then you also have to grease the skids by creating these networks to link people together. And both of those markets are a single-digit percentage of the overall market. MSC and FSC are in the single-digit in terms of percentages of those markets. But we hope to keep pushing and pushing and pushing until they reach a tipping point and the majority of the market becomes certified because that's what people are demanding. And we'll just keep working at it. And some of these things just are viral. They just create it. There's a certain tipping point where that they become what everybody expects and asks for, and that's what we hope for.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Tom Ramey. And I'd like to ask a question about the sort of fundamental logic conflict between environmentalism and capitalism, because it sounded like an awful lot of what you're doing sounds great, but it sounds like you're doing a lot of holding actions and saving what can be saved while losing other parts. And for every park success story on the one side, you've got Detroit taking advantage of loopholes to build giant SUVs and gas-guzzling SUVs and make huge profits at it because that's what they do. They make profit. So it seems like you're kind of stuck just in this particular strategy only doing holding actions. How do you get ahead of the game? How do you deal with that fundamental conflict between capitalism and environmentalism, short-term and long-term?
I don't feel stuck, but I do feel like we are David sometimes against Goliath. And we produce every year something called the Living Planet Report. And it tracks two things. It tracks a market basket of species, 2,000 species from around the world and their populations and how they're doing. And it tracks consumption patterns. And the unit of measurement is how many Earths do current consumption patterns demand in terms of the Earth's carrying capacity. And we've exceeded the level of one Earth right now. We have a living planet index, and we have a footprint index. And the species index is going in the wrong direction. It is going down. And the other index is going up in terms of our footprint on the Earth. And those lines are going in the wrong direction. They have been for decades. What we hope to do is to create some models and give people hope by making a difference, not everywhere, but in a few places. And so we picked 20 places around the world where we can change the trajectory of those lines. And so if you take that Living Planet Index and you do it for the Amazon, that you can see the trajectory changing. And the reason we're not taking on the whole world, we're just taking on a few strategic areas where we think we can make a difference. And correspondingly, we want to make a difference with a few key industry sectors that we've identified as the greatest threats. We've pulled 200 ecoregions around the world and asked, what are the top two threats to your ecoregion? The number one most frequently mentioned one is agricultural commodities, which was a surprise to me. And the number two is fishing practices. And the number three is international lending practices. And I don't think we can take on everything, but I think we need to pick our battles and make a measurable difference. I don't feel stuck. I feel like we're actually making a difference in those places. But my hope is that those examples will be the wellspring for international protocols on climate change, some other regulations that are like a Pan-Arctic treaty to govern what happens when the ice melts, the ships start coming through, and the oil starts being drilled. And because all those kind of regulations and protocols have to be based on reality somewhere. And so we're pursuing really positive actions in certain places, but we're continuing to work on some of these international treaties and protocols to address the larger scale issues you're talking about. But make no mistake about it, there's great urgency because the trends are going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and those indexes are long-term thinking, not short-term thinking, which is... Oh, sorry. Okay.
Thank you. My name is Don Langley. Whether it's for ivory or rhino horn or bushmeat, can you give us a quick update on the status of anti-poaching activities in Africa?
Sure. You can buy gorilla meat in the United States. You can go to any capital city in Africa and order up just about any animal you want and get it. And the patterns of use are that the fisheries off the coast of Africa are being, west coast of Africa, being decimated. People need protein, and they go into the forest. Logging companies come in to places like the Congo, and they build logging roads. They go into the forest. They bring in workers. They don't provide anything for them to eat. And so the bushmeat trade that you've talked about is decimating parts of Africa, even parts where parks exist. And one of the real priorities for us is addressing the bushmeat trade. We have gone so far to actually provide food for loggers in places like Sanga-Sanga and parts of the Congo. But what we're also trying to do is to create enforcement and policing and monitoring activities that eliminate both the source of bushmeat trade but also where it's being sold. And to elevate this issue, because it is an enormous issue in Africa that's afflicting wildlife. And just by raising the awareness of it and trying to create, just as we did with furs here in the United States, trying to create a cultural awareness of how this is decimating Africa's heritage and the impact that has on ecotourism and income to these countries, we're trying to address it. It's a major issue. On the other hand, there are parts of Africa where WWF actually has worked with local governments and local communities on very limited ecotourism and even limited hunting that returns profit to the local communities to conserve whole herds of animals. And you have to be really smart about it. But this bushmeat trade is really a disaster. Okay. So I'm really glad you asked the question. That we need to tell the story because it's out there, and it is not just limited to Africa. You can, as I said, you can go into these underground supermarket, underground stores in different parts of the world and find just about any animal you want. We estimate that the trade in wildlife, illegal trade in wildlife, is a $24 billion trade globally. One more question. Do we have time for one more?
Hi, my name is Randy Heilbrun. A few moments ago, you mentioned that sometimes you feel like David against Goliath, and David had a slingshot which used quite successfully to win that battle. I'm wondering what might be the single best slingshot that the World Wildlife Federation has across the board to bring us to success?
That's a good question. We have a lot of slingshots, but if you ask me to pick my favorite slingshot that we have, it is using a network to mobilize the world to take action to avert something in a single place. So if you take that heart of Borneo example, having somebody who is the voice of what's happening there to start an email campaign that has ripple effects in Europe and Asia and the United States and elsewhere to change what happens there, that's our best slingshot. And I think it reflects what's really unique about WWF as a global network. But the ability to communicate quickly and mobilize people to take action at different levels is something that is our best weapon, I think, right now in the world. And I've seen it work in a few places. We need to make it work more often.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you, Carter Roberts. For the radio audience, you've been listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we are talking to the CEO and president of the World Wildlife Fund. Now, let's give a big hand for him, for his coming. And our meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you very much.